I'm going to start off with an experiment this morning. I'm guessing that even if I hold this upside down, you automatically recognize what it is. Not just that it's a bottle of water, but if you can see the label even and you recognize it this way, that you automatically knew it was Arrowhead water. The official water, apparently, of Sinai Temple. And I bring that up because it wasn't until this week that I learned, although I suppose we know this, that if you hold someone's face upside down, it's very hard to recognize. But if you hold objects upside down, you recognize them. And I read this in an interview with Eric Kandel, who's a Nobel Prize winner, a physicist, and a medical researcher, and he said that's because the brain has special receptors for facial recognition. And so we don't process faces the way we process other objects, and so when you turn a face upside down, it messes with our receptors. And it becomes very difficult to recognize who that is that you're seeing. That's why, in fact, there are certain kinds of damage that you can do to the cerebral cortex that make it then impossible for people to recognize faces. Because it's separate from other recognitions. Now, this is not only something that is intrinsic, but in some ways, it's also acquired. And by that I mean that there are certain things in your life that you recognize in a way that other people don't. If you're running down a list and you see your own name, it looks different from all the other names. It just does. If you're reading along and different dates are being mentioned and one of them is your birthday, it looks different from all the other dates. And you know that to someone else it would look the same, but to you it looks different because you have a powerful association with that date, with that name, with that fact. And so just like our facial recognition, it lights up your brain in a different way. Today is the 24th of Iyar. That may mean nothing to you, but to me, it doesn't look like any other date. And the reason that that's so is that today, 5 years ago, my father passed away. And so his yahrzeit looks different to me than any other day. And when I see, if I'm reading Hebrew dates for one reason or another, the date, the 24th of Iyar, it lights up on its own as unique. And it is a tradition, in fact, on a yahrzeit to teach words of Torah in honor of the person who has passed away. And so when I saw that this Shabbat fell on the 24th of Iyar, I knew that I had to say something about my father. And in some way, to tie a lesson from his life to the lesson of the parsha. So let me start with the parsha, and then move on to the lesson. Bamidbar, at the beginning, embodies a certain contradiction that in fact, in time, seems to be a complementarity, that actually works for itself, although at first you might think that it's at odds with itself. And you can see the difference in the Hebrew name and the English name of the book. The Hebrew name is Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. In other words, wild, open, vast, uncharted, no discipline, no meticulousness. You have to be patuach kamidbar to receive Torah, say the rabbis. You have to be open like a wilderness. But in English, the book is called Numbers. In other words, exact, meticulous, counting, determined, bounded. The exact opposite of the Hebrew name. Because the first parsha is all about taking a census. And in fact, we have L'chol mishpachotam, for every family and every individual and every tribe throughout Israel, there's a count. So you see these two opposing ideals, the ideal of openness, receptiveness, and creativity, and the idea of discipline, meticulousness, and boundaries, all in the name of this book of the Torah that we began this morning. And I think, as I reflect on my father's life, that those two ideals were combined in a beautiful way. In fact, he started off when he was young in a field that combines exactly those things. Because when he was young, my father aspired to be a concert pianist. And he was apparently very gifted at the piano. In later years, he used to play us things and deliberately make mistakes to make us laugh. But I never really heard him play the way he played when he was young. And two things interfered with that career. One was the death of his own father when he was 11. But the other thing he told me in later years was because there was a boy who lived down the street who used to play at all the bar and bat mitzvahs who convinced him that he could never really become the musician he wanted to be. The boy's name was Leonard Bernstein. And he said, you know, when that's your competition, who used to play at the bar and bat mitzvahs, and when you saw how gifted Bernstein was, you said to yourself, you know, I can play piano, but I'm a little bit outclassed here. But music combines exactly those two ideals. That is, yes, musicians are enormously creative, but you can't sit down at a piano and say, I'm just going to be creative, unless you've done a tremendous amount of practice. And I remember those hand exercises, because I took piano lessons, that you had to do for hours before the teacher was ready to let you play any sort of piece that had in it any spark of creativity. And you begin to learn, I think, through a musical instrument, the combination of discipline and creativity that is embodied in Numbers Bamidbar. My father, as most of you know, went on to become a rabbi. And in that, also had those two ideals as a sort of marriage inside his professional personality as well as his personality as a human being. That is, when he retired, in addition to distributing his library among his four children in a, by the way, a meticulous and brilliant way, and I advise this to you, if you have a lot of books and you happen to have several children and you don't know how to decide how to give what to whom, do what my father did, which is he invited us to his study one day and he gave all of us little post-it notes of different colors. And he said, okay, you go around and you put the post-it note on whichever book you want. If it only has your color on it, it's yours. If it has multiple colors on it, those you put in the middle, and then you start trading. And that's what we did. But one thing that he gave to me was that he had thousands of note cards. And on those note cards were stories, anecdotes, quotes, teachings, things that he had heard his teacher say. And I realized that for years he had this file system in which he used to keep all the stuff that he had learned. And one of the reasons why my father always had a story for everything, or a quote, or an anecdote, is because over the years he had copied and recopied them and kept them in this file. So what seemed like spontaneous creativity, and to some extent was also the discipline of learning all these stories. And many of the stories that you have heard me tell over the years came from him through those notes. And if you ask him, and I did, how did he learn to speak publicly, which is something that people ask me all the time, he gave the same answer that I did. which is through practice. Not only did he practice in front of a mirror, which he told me he did for years, but he used to do the same thing that he taught me to do early on, which was to tape himself and then listen to himself speaking. Hear when he slowed down, when he sped up, when he used a word that was difficult for some people to understand and didn't define it, when he did define it, when he used synonyms and how helpful it was, when he used a story that worked and he used a story that didn't work. In other words, the creativity was a foundation of discipline. And that was how he learned over the years to present publicly. And then gave me the best piece of professional advice I ever had when I went off to study at what is now the American Jewish University, then called the University of Judaism. And in fact, if you're interested in public speaking and you have a child who's going off to college, I advise you to give them the same piece of advice. He said, when you get there, the first day you arrive at school, find your way to the development office. That's where they raise money. And say to them, hello, my name is David Wolpe, and I guess that you probably sometimes have students go out and speak on behalf of the school. I'd like to do that. He said, they will send you out, and sometimes you'll speak to 2 people, and sometimes you'll speak to 1,000, and you will get experience in speaking to different groups at different times, and that will be invaluable. And so, all through my years of rabbinical school, I spoke to dinners, to breakfast, to events, all because I was the only student, surprise, surprise, who walked into the development office and said, here I am. And in fact, there are people sitting in this congregation whom I met at UJ breakfasts and dinners and an occasional lunch because my father gave me that advice. In other words, learn the discipline of speaking in front of a group so that when you want to be creative, you'll have that foundation. In his rabbinate, he did some very creative things. It may or may not surprise you that I am the son of the rabbi who hired the first female rabbi ordained by the conservative movement. His congregation was not entirely happy about that. So if you think that sometimes I do controversial things, all I can say is I come by it honestly. It's a family legacy. But he did. And in time, what was revolutionary became conventional. It might happen with other things too. One never knows. But he was allowed to express this creativity because he had first established the discipline that was the frame around the picture. Because, of course, that's what you have to decide first. When an artist is going to create a picture, they have to decide the size and scale. In other words, the boundaries come before the creativity. What it's going to be, how big it's going to be, the medium in which the art is going to be created, all of the discipline, all of the counting, that all comes before the wilderness. So what did the Israelites do? They went into the wilderness to receive the law. They went into the place with no boundaries in order to learn God's boundaries. And that lesson, over and over and over again, is a lesson of religious life. Even Jewish mystics have their teachings written in books. In other words, mysticism, which is the most boundaryless, open and creative part of the tradition in some ways, is enshrined in very specific exercises, books, and boundaries. I remember my father all the time. But on his yahrzeit, you're supposed to say Kaddish. There's a boundary for the wilderness. Those of you who have lost people know that there's a boundary to the mourning. That you can be sad for as long as you wish, but you only say Kaddish for a certain amount of time. You only sit Shiva for a certain amount of time. There's always, to the wilderness, accounting. There's always, to the creativity, the artistry, the sadness, the beauty, a boundary. I could tell you many other stories about my father's life, and I have in the past, and I'm sure I will in the future, but I will just tell you how he spent the last years of his life. I know that some people, when they retire, spend their time mourning the fact that they aren't back doing what they did before. That wasn't my father. When he left the synagogue, and they used to invite him back, he would say, no, it's fine. I'm perfectly happy. He first of all took care of my mother, who was not well, but the other thing he did, which expresses so perfectly the combination of creativity and discipline, was he spent his time growing orchids. And in fact, the last picture I have, which my brother took of him, was when they went together to the orchid show in Philadelphia. And when I think about the brackets of his life, music at the beginning and flowers at the end, I realize that they both perfectly embody that combination of discipline, because you know, if you grow something, you have to do it right, but also creativity, because walking into their apartment, there was a burst of color that was a testament to the creativity that discipline allows. So that's what Bamidbar teaches us. And on his yahrzeit, in his memory, it's what I wish to teach. How important it is, if you're going to be creative, to be meticulous. If you're going to have things burst out of you, to make sure first they have a foundation. A year or two ago, I said, first in a sermon and then online, that creativity without discipline is like a blender without a top. But with discipline, it makes a wonderful and beautiful thing, a magnificent tradition, and a treasured memory that is a blessing. Shabbat Shalom.